Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Welcome to the most exciting broadcast hour of our broadcast day. Yes, it's time for the Science Forum on Vox Pop. We welcome back a team of three brilliant scientists who answer all your questions. The lines are now open, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. It's a 50-50 shot. I'll find it, but you know, hey, give it a try. Or you could call 800-348-2551. Yes, the Science Forum. Very smart people are here, and they're here to help you. Give us a call. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Can you feel it? That palpable energy in Studio A? The excitement that is emanating from our broadcast center here in Albany? Well, you're absolutely right, because today we convene the Science Forum. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Interesting questions, if you have them. Boring questions, if you have those. It really doesn't matter. 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. I'm in charge of watching the emails today. So, again, I'll do my best, but if they slip through, don't yell at me later. 800-348-2551. As I mentioned, it is the Science Forum. So, at this time, let us have our scientists sign in, please.
Ed Stander, I thought it was a silence forum, so I'm going to have to get used to this.
Well, in your
this.
Case, that would be an improvement.
Now, Stuni Koppel skill, geology, astronomy, and anything that Barbara or Jim can't answer.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm a organic chemist.
Hi, Jim.
And I'm Barbara Brabetz from Stuni Koppel skill, and I teach biology and chemistry, and I am a biochemist. Shocker.
What does that mean?
Well, I teach biology and chemistry. You put them together, you smush them, you get biochemistry.
So I'm a gastronomer?
I don't know.
Okay.
Pilot higher and deeper, Ed. There you go.
Maybe we should just start again.
Actually, no, I'd be an astrologer.
That's right.
So if anybody has any questions of the future, I think I can answer them.
So speaking of the future, this is the last show before the beginning of the semester. You excited?
I have to sharpen my red pens.
This is great, isn't it? You look forward to this. And Ed, you've been relaxing now for several months.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
I've been saving it up. I'm waiting to just explode.
So you were on sabbatical. You were up looking at water or something.
Yeah, I was up in northern Quebec looking at water.
Okay. And how'd that go?
It's pretty well the same as down here.
Fair enough. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones. And David in Catskill. David, you're first.
Good afternoon. My question pertains to ticks. I'm an old man, and I live in a house in the woods. And they are a problem as far as I'm concerned. They don't frighten me particularly, but I'm not always able to reach them physically on my body. In other words, if I get a tick on my back, either I have to make a trip to a neighbor or find a long thing to probe it with. And the thought occurred to me that there was probably something as simple as a mustard or ketchup that you could put on a tick and that would so disturb the tick that it would withdraw by itself. And that was question one, if there was such a thing. And question two, in that case, would the tick get so excited, if you will pardon that phrase, get so excited that it would eject whatever poisons or whatever that I'm worried about. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. I think I've got it. Yep.
Yep.
So the good thing, bad thing, it's a good thing if you're a tick, and a bad thing to try to get rid of them is they have their skeleton on their outside.
Mm.
So think of it like it's actually in the same classification as spiders, but think of them like a beetle that's really, really small.
Pardon me. hang up. Can I hang up and,
sure.
and go listen on the radio because I can't hear here?
Absolutely.
Okay?
Yes, absolutely,
Thank
David.
You.
Thank you for the call. Okay, so go ahead, Barbara.
So they have an exoskeleton, which makes them relatively impervious to things like water, you know, drought, for example. They can keep all their moisture in as long as they can, and also makes them pretty impervious to pesticides, which is one of the reasons why ticks have continued to be a problem, even in your household pets. With the advent of some of these new topical treatments that you have on the back of the neck for a dog or a cat, you'll still find that ticks are the ones that are still hanging in there.
Yeah.
We kill off the weak ones, and then we allow the strong ones to reproduce because they, but kind of an unnatural selection, if you will. So it's really quite difficult to get rid of them. There are prescription medications that you could get, and I would recommend that David do so, that are topical, that if you can reach the area but can't really grab on, you can apply it to that area, and it will allow the tick to, it will kind of force the tick to get the heck off.
Huh. Okay.
But as far as, I think the, call a phone a friend for the tick removal is probably his best.
A very understanding friend.
Yeah, I've got to say, you know, that's, I guess, why you keep a spouse around, right?
Yeah, so, it'll work. Although I had a tick bite one time on my back, and my wife was not all
was
that jazzed
screaming?
About
yeah.
getting
right.
getting the tick
it's
out.
It's not a turn on,
yeah,
I would say.
No.
Does the old Boy Scout method of Vaseline on the tick work?
Well, it does because it suffocates the tick. But the problem with the tick-borne diseases is, the medical profession says it takes about 24 hours of attachment to transmit the bacteria that cause a whole host of problems in ticks. And the Vaseline takes a while to kill it off. So if, you know, you kind of run the chance that they may be swapping spit with you, with your blood supply, in the time that they're suffocating. And when it comes to the toxins and poisons, really it's just that ticks have a dirty mouth. It's not that they themselves are poisonous to us or toxic to us, but rather they feast on other animals, and then those contagious diseases propagate in them, and then they're just passing them on. So think of them like a dirty doorknob that's attached to your back.
Yeah, the other thing you might consider, as I understand it, is that ticks don't like some things that you can ingest. For example, thiamine. If you take an overdose of thiamine, which you can't actually do, but if you take a large quantity of it before you go outside, it keeps the ticks from wanting to bite you, as well as mosquitoes to some extent.
And there are some over-the-counter repellents available in New York State that you can spray your clothing with that will make them stay away. It's mm-hmm. it's not a tick killer. It's more a tick repellent, if you will.
Right. So you cannot overdose on thiamine?
No. It's a B vitamin, B complex vitamin, so it just comes out when you go to the bathroom.
All right. Let's go to Joanne and Rhinebeck. Joanne, you're
hey,
on.
Alan.
Hello? Hello? Hey, you got to turn your radio down. Okay. Hello? Oh, this is not working out. Okay. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number.
So tonight, everybody should go outside if it turns out to be a nice night and take a look at the meteor shower.
Very exciting. The Perseids tonight,
the Perseids. And the last time we passed through the particular cloud that we're going through this time was in the 1860s, and it was a major, major storm. So there is a good possibility that there may be 200 or more per hour if you're in a dark place.
Okay. Oh.
So why do we go through a different region of the comet tail every year?
Well, now you're giving it away. What we're doing is the Earth is going through a cloud of cometary material. In this case, it's Comet Swift-Tuttle. And because the comet follows pretty well the same path each time, except for slight variations due to the outer planets as it goes by, such as Jupiter,
yes,
we leave a path of material behind as it goes through. And as we go through that path, which typically takes 1 or 2 days as we go around the sun, we get into these meteor showers. So sometimes there, some of these paths are thousands of years old, and as a result, there's not much material left. Sometimes the comet was in its process of destroying itself, and so we get lots of material. And in this case, this happens to be a pretty massive cloud.
Okay, and so what is your percentage of certitude that it will be an above-average show this evening?
Well, according to most scientists who've looked at it, it's very high. The best time to look at it, by the way, will be after the moon has gone down.
So 1 or 2 in the morning.
1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And they're figuring, usually they'll get 50 to 100 in dark skies, but they're figuring upwards of 200 or more
this
year.
That's pretty exciting.
So I think we've just planned everyone's night for them. First, the tick check until about 1 a.m.
Yep.
Right.
Then the thiamine.
Then you know.
Then you go outside.
Yeah, do a thiamine shot and then go on out and take a look at what you see in the sky.
Right, between the clouds.
And sleep it off the next day.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brobbins is here, Jim Pickett and Ed Stander. Yours truly, Ray Graff. This one came in at voxpop@wamc.org. Good afternoon, it begins. We all love a blue sky on a beautiful day. So why is the sky blue? How does the sky become blue every day? And why not at night? That's from Mark. Why not at night?
Why not at night?
He said with emphasis.
Barbara, why don't you take that one?
I am not. You teach geology and astronomy. That's somewhere in between there is the sky.
I bet Jim has this down.
Well, I could do that too, but we have an
take
astronomer
it
here.
Okay, yeah. I'll take it.
Fine.
Jeez.
Well, the sky isn't really astronomy, right?
The sky is not astronomy.
Yeah.
Right. Although the reason meteors are called meteors is because they occur in the sky. And just like meteorology, which is the study of the sky, meteors occur in the sky. So there is a little bit of that.
Brilliant.
But anyway, yeah, the reason the sky is blue is because light coming from the sun gets scattered by particles within the sky. And of the light that comes from the sun, the one that gets scattered the most is the blue light.
Okay.
So as a result, if you look at anywhere but the sun, where effectively you're seeing everything but the blue, if you look anywhere else, what you're seeing is the scattered light that's being effectively moved around by these little particles that are in the atmosphere.
Is it a specific particle, nitrogen or oxygen or anything like
no,
that?
No, it's anything, any very, very, very fine particle.
So even dust would do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, yes.
Dust,
yeah.
Rain does it.
In fact, if you look at mountains, Purple's Mountain's Majesty,
yes.
You know, above the Fruited Plain?
Right.
It's purple because the light coming from the sun is being reflected from those mountains, and the blue is being scattered the most. So you get the same thing.
Fascinating.
And the reason why...
The gas itself will do the scattering because of little momentary clusters of the molecules will scatter the light. So you don't actually need particulate dust, but that helps. The gas itself will scatter.
Right. And depending on how much dust there is, you'll get just blue being scattered or maybe blue and green being scattered, which makes more of a turquoise color. Mm-hmm. So if the sky is more turquoise, it's because there's more scattering. Or at night, when the sun is coming through the most atmosphere because it's near the horizon, you get blue and green scattered. And then the light that comes from the sun is red, which is why you get a red sunset.
Fantastic. We'll take a break here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
From Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. Colby Attorney Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for legal and professional communities since 1939. ColbyService.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. Preservation League of New York State offering EPIP, a revolving loan program to acquire, stabilize, and restore historic buildings in New York, so our past has a future. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. Rhinebeckart.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and it's the Science Forum. And we're off to a crackling good start today. We talked about the blue sky, and
we have more answers too.
Did you say the sky on Venus is yellow?
Sky on Venus
and that's
is yellow.
Sulfuric acid or something?
Yeah, and the sky on Mars is pink.
Okay, and why?
Mostly communism.
That's hilarious. You remember this is NPR. That kind of joke doesn't fly.
You
know. So why is the sky pink on Mars?
Dust.
And a thin environment, thin atmosphere.
Yeah, there's not much gas.
Significantly thinner.
Not much gas, but quite a bit of
scattering.
Dust.
Mm-hmm.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to John in Pittsfield. John, you're on the Science Forum. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I had a question about nuclear energy. I've been doing a little bit of reading on it, and was surprised to find that there's other ways to generate electricity with nuclear energy, specifically thorium, in a molten salt reactor. And I saw why we didn't go with it. I mean, the United States wanted to make bombs, and you can't make bombs with a thorium reactor, but you get all the electricity. But my question was, from what I'm reading, it says that they're able to use uranium in a thorium reactor so that they could use all this unused fuel that is sitting on at all these reactors across the country, and could be put into a thorium reactor and fizzed down till they're gone, no more waste. And I was just wondering, how are they able to use a solid fuel from the current uranium reactors and put those into a molten salt reactor?
Okay, well, Barbara, who wants this?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that fuel cycle works, but the molten salt is probably the coolant. The fuel will still be solid.
Okay.
So if that's in fact the case, they would all the fuel would be solid in there.
I did read long ago that the reason why we went away from molten salt, and I don't know if this is the real reason or if it's just one contributing reason, is that firefighting with a molten salt reactor would be extremely difficult. So similar to what happened with Chernobyl, when they were firefighting, they ended up with quite a plume, and you would end up with the same issue because the molten salt would react with the water.
And the other part.
What I was able to see about that, it's interesting you brought that up, is that with a molten salt reactor, there is no threat of a meltdown because the fuel is a liquid. And so if the vessel was to crack, the molten salt was to spill out into the floor, it would solidify.
As long as it didn't have another energy source to keep it molten.
Interesting.
Right, because so it'll still melt if you give it enough heat.
And the other part of your question is that uranium has a very, very long half-life. So while it could be used there, it would still come to a point where we'd have to be able to find some place to store the refuge when it's done.
Yeah, the half-life is on the order of 10 to the 9 years, so a billion years.
Yeah, yikes.
From what I see is that the uranium reactor, I think they said is, I couldn't believe it, they said a uranium reactor is less than 99% efficient. They're only burning 1% of the fuel, and that most of that waste could be used in a molten salt reactor.
I don't know where what the numbers are. The good news about that is we just do heat transfer, basically. We
right.
take a hot thing that's nuclear, and we don't commingle it, but we put it next to a non-radioactive cold liquid that then gets hot. So all we're doing is really capturing the heat from the nuclear reaction. So that, you know, it's what we do with combustion engines. It's really what we do with the fireplace, right? We're just, you know, if you had a wood boiler in your house, you're just taking cold water, running it through the wood boiler, making it hot, and then having it go through your radiator. So from that perspective, how you generate the hot thing theoretically doesn't matter. You just have to think about all the costs associated with it, and then, you know, what do you do if something goes wrong? It's really infrequent that something goes wrong with nuclear reactors, but when it does, it's going to be a big thing.
John, thank you very much for the call. It is the Science Forum on Vox Pop today. 800-348-2551. Kathy in Egremont. Kathy, you're on.
Hi. I just heard your discussion about the Perseus showers, and if I'm going to get up at 2 in the morning, I'd like to know whether I should look northeast, west, or south, or if it doesn't make any difference.
The reason it's called the Perseid shower is because the place where most of the meteors will come from is from the constellation of Perseus. And that'll be rising, as everything in the world, it'll be rising on the east and setting towards the west. So if you look towards the east, you should see it the best. But the trick is that they're going to be covering the whole sky. It's just that's the location where they start from. So if you were to draw a line from all their tails to one point, it would be towards Perseus.
Okay, so the best vantage point would be the whole sky.
Oh, yeah, straight up would be by far the best place to see them.
And so I think really whatever you have accessible to you in your area, like think about having as much of an open sky as possible. you're going to see them because they're going to streak right there and grab your eye.
Right. And if you go into a field, watch out for the ticks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This one came in via email at voxpop@wamc.org. David in Poughkeepsie wants to know, will the meteor shower be visible from the International Space Station?
Oh, yeah.
It may be too visible.
Oh, yeah. They're hoping it stays far away.
Okay.
Those little guys are going fast, those little pieces of fragment.
About 400,000 miles an
hour.
And
they're running at 17,000 miles an hour in the space station, and there's really no, it's not a good collision.
Yeah. All right, this is an odd question. In fact, that's the subject heading from Ramon in Montgomery. Panel, it's you. We all know about atomic fission splitting the atom and the power release, but what about the bonds on the scale up? Why is steel harder, a conglomerate of carbon and iron, to cut than cake, a conglomerate of sugars? Conglomerates are bonded on the molecular level, yes. So what makes the bonds of metal so strong? A hard substance does not have to have a hard bond. Look at glass. So what is the dynamic that regulates bonds between molecules? Is it electrons?
That's an awesome question.
Okay. Well done, Ramon.
Yes, all the bonding is electrons. And it's some of this has to do with density, the fact that you guys have a lot of stuff in steel. It's also crystalline, which the things are packed in there tightly and
in a regular repeating pattern.
In a regular repeating pattern, mm-hmm. and it's hard to break the crystals.
Okay.
So that's one reason why it's hard to cut hard to cut through steel.
Right, and when you want to make a more pliable steel, because you don't want brittleness, because that can happen if you make it too stiff, then what you do is you dope it by putting in carbon and sulfur and a couple other things to kind of give it a little bit more pliability. It is like baking in a way.
Actually.
But the metallic bonds are fundamentally different than covalent bonds. Now, covalent bonds are sharing of electrons. When you're breaking a piece of cake, you are not breaking bonds.
Okay.
So the thought is, well, I'm cutting it, so I must be breaking bonds. No,
nope.
You're separating individual atoms apart.
Okay, so I would not be in danger of a fission nuclear reaction if I cut a piece of cake.
Depends on where you're sitting, but no.
Okay.
No.
And I would like to point out, just for posterity's sake, that if you add carbon to steel, it becomes harder and more brittle. And that's because when you add carbon to steel and then you work it, it develops a lot of little tangles in its structure, which make it much more difficult to be pliable. So what you do to make it softer is not add carbon to the steel, which is a carbon steel knife, which keeps an edge very long, but you stick it in water.
Right, you anneal it.
You very, very slowly, so all those things are able to get out.
Right, and that has to do with that crystalline structure again.
Right.
Moving the carbon into these spaces between the bonds, between the atoms, and that's where we push the carbon in order to get that strength again.
Okay.
Yeah, and when you make stuff where you actually do have to more or less break bonds, let's say a hunk of plastic, where now you have very long molecules, and if you cut that, to some extent, you're pushing molecule chains out of the way, but you're also breaking the bonds, and that's a lot harder than cutting a piece of cake, where you're just kind of pushing chunks of the conglomerate that makes the cake. You're just
very
pushing
interesting.
Those apart.
Well, that was a very interesting and extensive email question.
It's a great odd question, but 99.999% of what we think of as an atom is air, is space. So it's easy to cut through space.
We are joined today by Barbara Brobitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. And Nancy in Amsterdam. Nancy.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm loving this. Anything science is just fascinating. But since you're all educators, I imagine that when you go back to school, you teach with a textbook, which I found textbooks to be, prohibitive. They're not interesting. They're not usually, engaging. And I'm wondering if you can recommend from each of your backgrounds a book that might be a little bit more engaging than a textbook, but still impart, some valuable and useful knowledge. If you could recommend a book, that would be awesome.
Anybody?
Wow.
There's thousands. I mean, in astronomy, there's thousands of books. You just have to go to a place like Barnes & Noble and take a look at the shelf. The textbooks, generally speaking, try to cover too much material in too short a period. So, for example, in my class, I don't even use a textbook anymore. I just put a whole bunch of typical books that you'd get out of the library and let people look at them
as they
wish.
And then you have a rap session, kind of like a 60s thing.
Yeah.
Sit around in a circle.
We all sit around in a circle and...
Rap session. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like...
talk about the stars.
Do you have one in particular that you might recommend that you like?
Stickies?
Oh, yeah. Sticky Nights. If you want to learn the sky, Sticky Night Stars is one of the best books out there. It's a beautiful thing. And all it does is it goes through each page, and you have to find them and figure out what they are, and it tells you the story behind them.
Huh.
It's the only book I require my students to buy, and it's $13.
Yeah, and there's some good chemistry books. Is it Peter Atkins?
Yeah, Atkins has a terrific book. But it's not really entertaining in the way that Nancy describes.
Yeah.
I think a good one to start, if you want to kind of probe into the process of how science is born, which is not pretty, but there's a method, then there's a bunch of books that you can read that look at historically relevant scientific discoveries and then all the stumbling blocks along. In search of the double helix is one of them, which talks about finding DNA and how that was all discovered. Bill Bryson. Yes, you want to talk about the theory of everything?
The brief history of everything.
Yes, by Bill Bryson, which is a terrific, excellent book. I'd also recommend Seven Easy Pieces by Richard Feynman, who is a physicist who was a brilliant teacher as well as a great discoverer and has a Nobel Prize. So those are some.
Okay.
Any others, Jim?
I think that nothing comes to mind right away.
Okay.
Right. So we got biology, physics, and astronomy covered. We kind of left chemistry in the dirt.
All right. Yeah. Well,
Bill
Nancy,
Bryson.
Thank you so
Bill
much
Bryson.
For that call. It is the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Now, remember the great question from Ramon a few moments ago. And he's breaking a cardinal rule of this program, but because his question was so good, I'm going to let him do a follow-up. And he says, I thought steel was iron and carbon. What did he mean by steel and carbon?
Carbon, there's numerous types of steel. There's stainless steel, there's low-carbon steel, there's high-carbon steel. Carbon is an impurity that's added to change the specifications, the structure of the steel. So, for example, stainless steel, like your Victorinox, knife, keeps an edge for about 5 seconds when you use it because it's stainless steel. And stainless steel, generally speaking, is because it's stainless, it has no impurities to cause it to rust, and it doesn't keep an edge. While high-carbon steel, which is what I use in my kitchen, and you can't really find very easily, is a steel that rusts very, very easily, but it also keeps an edge for a very, very long time because of these tangles called dislocation tangles that are within the steel. So they're just variations of the same material, depending on what the impurity is.
But steel is mostly iron.
Mostly iron, of course.
All right, let's...
Well, I just want to correct. I mean, stainless steel isn't a matter of not having purity. Stainless steel has a lot of other elements
alloys.
In it.
It's an alloy,
particularly nickel and chromium.
Right.
Right, but we call impurities the things that make it messy.
Yeah. All right, before we get back to the phones, one more email, and this one came in from Beth. Why does the moisture in clouds make them look gray? Is it that less light is able to get through the clouds because of the increased moisture?
Exactly. You have more droplets of water scattering light sideways, so less comes through that you can see.
Right, there's no direct path for the light to come through.
All right, let's go over to Joe in Johnstown. Joe, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you. I just want to share this with your listeners. This harkens back to the gentleman who called about putting mustard or ketchup on a tick if it's lodged in your skin.
Yeah.
A number of years ago, my wife got a tick attached to her body in Branson, Missouri, and we went to the local clinic there, and the physician's assistant saturated a cotton ball with rubbing alcohol and just swabbed gently the tick with rubbing alcohol, and the thing immediately let go. And then the doctor just plucked it off with a tweezer and advised us to do the same thing if we ever had a tick bite again, tick lodged on us.
Yeah, what do you think, panel?
Well, I mean, it's worth a try. Of course, if it's on your back, I don't know how he's going to get it on. Yeah, it's still going to be tricky.
Take an alcohol bath. Right?
I've heard people put sriracha on it, but sriracha can burn your skin.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's delicious.
It is, but it can burn your skin.
Tick-flavored sriracha is
lovely. All right. Thank you for that call. We appreciate it. And over to Michael and Troy. Michael, you're on.
Hi. I got another thing about related to the ticks.
Well, of course.
The diamond.
Okay.
my ears perked up when you said insects are repelled by it and mosquitoes. What about lice?
Lice. What about lice?
Okay, so lice and ticks are in that same category. Fleas, lice, and ticks are in that arachnid category, same as the spiders.
Okay.
They also have an exoskeleton, but lice are more selective as to who they're on and how long they can persist off body. So they're much more delicate and easier to kill than the others so far.
Okay.
Right, but with taking time and help repel them. My kids once got that from school.
Well, often if they're on you, they're there to lay eggs. They're not necessarily there to feed on you. I mean, yes, they feed on you, but what they do is they lay their eggs so that when their eggs hatch, they feed on you. So, you know, most people would be kind of grossed out to the thought of, okay, the lice eggs are on me, but
sure,
the adult lice are gone. So I don't know if it would be enough of a repellent to really satisfy today's standard.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Quickly before the next break, let's go to Steve in Albany. Steve.
Yes. Well, before you were talking about the color of the sky, and you said because there were blue particles scattering the light, that's why the sky is blue.
No, I don't think they said that.
Not blue not blue particles.
No, just particles.
Just particles.
Particles that are scattering the blue light.
Correct.
So the sky is blue.
Right.
And then when you go to the sundown, you had particles scattering the blue and green lights, and that's why the sky is red.
Oh, it's because as the blue and green is scattered out of the sun's rays, the only color that's left is red, and that's why the sun looks red. And then that red light is
so it's really a matter of the scattering at sundown is going away from the surface, whereas the scattering during the day is coming to the surface?
Effectively, yes, that we're in the path of seeing the blue during the day, but we're not in that path at night because the angle of the sun has changed
right,
and where it is relative to
the
atmosphere.
As Barbara commented earlier, the sky is blue really because the sun is yellow. The two are related to each other. If you get rid of blue from white light, you're left with yellow, which is why the sun is somewhat yellow. If you get rid of blue and green, then you get red, and so the red comes through at the sunset because you're going through more polluted light, if you will, more polluted atmosphere.
So to translate, yeah. Ed.
and then if it's a little bit cloudy, then that's where the red from the clouds comes from, is because there's so much of, because essentially the clouds are being illuminated by red light from the sun,
right?
Because the other colors have been scattered away.
It is the Science Forum on WAMC. Our number is 800-348-2551. We'll take a short break and then back for the home stretch.
Comes from Mabee Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, presenting the annual Arts and Crafts Festival featuring regional handmade arts and crafts including jewelry, clothing, pottery, baskets, soaps, and more. August 27th, 10 to 3, SchenectadyHistorical.org. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including memory care and more. Caring in the family tradition. 518-393-8800. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, offering traditional lobster bake every Sunday, eat in or take out. Real Seafood Lobster Bake at realseafoodco.com.
It's a little funky on the program here. It's the Science Forum, the funky old Science Forum here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Ray Graff here, joined by brilliant people all, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And before we get back to the phones, you wanted to
A little sunset experiment for our callers interested in the scattering of light from the sun. If you get a really good sunset, just kind of sit there and look at the red. And then if you kind of crane your neck up a bit, you'll see that it's really a diffuse rainbow as you go up. It's much redder at the surface. And then as you move up, and actually the apparent distance or thickness of the atmosphere decreases, you can see it go kind of the oranges and the yellows and then into the greens and the blues. And so it's just this very diffuse sunset as you look upwards towards the top of the sky at a beautiful sunset.
Very interesting. Anybody else?
Nope.
Okay, and then we'll get back to the phones in a moment. But this email came in regarding a blood study, and this is from John. I heard a few years back about a rat study that showed dramatic effects on aging rats by replacing their blood with the blood of young rats. Last week I heard this is now in human trials in California. Is there anything to this? I assume they're not putting rat blood into humans, but they're putting young human blood into older humans.
Oh, yes, it's very good.
Does it work? Yeah.
Oh, yes, I love to drink the blood.
All right, fine.
You know, it's interesting. I did read that study. The evidence seems pretty concrete, but it's not a lasting effect. So
you have to do it over.
You have to do it over and over and over again.
Interesting.
And you'll end up with a stake through your heart sooner or later.
So this is how Keith Richards continues to go.
He's got some blood bank made of 20 somethings.
That's right. Let's go to David in Patterson. David.
Yes, thank you. Before I ask my question, I just want to make a comment. I'd like to suggest to the person who is interested in your own books about science that perhaps they might look at some of the writings of Sir Peter Medawar, who was a Nobel Prize-winning biologist, and he did work in immunology. And in some of his writings will give a flavor to, you know, how science differs from literature and other fields, and I just thought I'd recommend that. But the question I wanted to ask was, I've heard Stephen Hawking talking about how black holes radiate, and I'm not sure I understand the mechanism. The only thing I can think of is that sometimes you get what are called virtual pairs produced, you know, electron-positron pair, and if the black hole absorbs one of the particles, the other one becomes a free particle. Is that too naive, or is that what happens, or what?
Well, do you know what they call that kind of radiation that Hawking describes?
Yes, what do they call it?
Hawking radiation. I know. We've got to get a better PR bunch going in science. We could sell our rights to Coca-Cola or,
but yes, that's
NPR.
That's
bright radiation. I see what you're saying.
That is the basic idea. That's how some energy could be lost from the black hole. Just recently, it's also been suggested that there may actually be a way out of the black hole through the other side. The idea being that material entering the black hole through the singularity may actually wind up, and some people are actually going back to the idea that there can be a tunnel, that you can wind up going somewhere else through a black hole. Okay.
But it may not be the same stuff on this. Yeah, it's kind of whatever's left over gets on the other side.
Right.
All right, David, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it very much. And let's see, who's been waiting longest? Let's go to Richard in Schenectady. Richard.
Yes, thank you, panel, and Ray.
Ray.
My question is about the weather. I look at the meteorologists at night on the news, and I see we get the weather that comes from the west of us. And I thought, well, you know, I thought about it a little bit. I said, well, it must be the rotation of the Earth. But then I realized the Earth itself also rotates from west to east. And it would seem to me that the I'm not sure what's more relevant here, the momentum of a solid or the cohesiveness of a solid would be greater than the momentum or the cohesiveness of our gaseous atmosphere. So it seems to me like we'd outpace the weather to the west of us, and we would get the weather that's over the Atlantic Ocean. What is there about the atmosphere, the way it operates, that we get the weather from the west of us?
Understand? We understand. We're breathing because it's going to take a bit.
Well, go ahead. I got time.
One of the reasons why we get weather is a lot of our weather is driven by the poles and what happens at the poles. So seeing as we're Northern Hemisphere, then the North Pole drives a lot of our weather. So how the circulation of air and wind and moisture happens at the poles kind of gets spiraled out like a spirograph to the rest of the planet. Additionally, our mass that's to our west is land mass, which heats up much more quickly and cools down much more quickly than the oceans that are to our east. So if we had, if we were in the middle of a continent and we had the same thing on both sides continuously, like there was no ocean, we would have pretty boring weather. It would be awful weather, but it'd be pretty boring. But this mix...
What direction would it come from, or would it go?
It would be driven by the pole. So the problem is we've got I got naysayers at the table already. But the irregular heating of the landmass versus the water mass is probably a much bigger force than the rotation of our planet.
Actually, if I may as well.
Yes, meteor guy.
Yeah, I had this question in class one day, and it drove me crazy for about 3 days, so I had to read up on it. Basically, if you can imagine the winds blowing, the winds are going to have to move a lot faster at the equator than they do at the poles.
It's true.
So they're moving faster at one end than at the other. At the poles, effectively, they could just sit there. At the equator, they have to move quite fast because of the rotation of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine that you have a long walkway with a pin in the center, and the walkway is rotating. Okay, so you're standing on it. If you're standing right at the pin, you won't feel any motion, or you'll feel rotation only. If you stand further and further away from that point with your eyes closed, even though the thing is moving in one direction, you'll feel like you're moving in the other direction because of the difference in speed at different points along that line. So the reason the wind is doing that, really, for the most part, and there are, of course, local effects such as water and all the rest of it, the main reason is that the Earth is round, and as a result, the winds are blowing at variable speeds depending on where you are on the planet.
All right, Richard. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. Somebody want to add anything?
I just want to add, I lived in Europe for a while, and in Europe, the predominant weather goes east to west, not west to east. So the opposite direction, but it's yet still in the north hemisphere.
All right, let's go to Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Keep the Artie Shaw going, okay?
Ha-ha, there you go.
I found a piece of material in the Hoosick River Valley that is, it feels like iron and it rusts like iron, but it is non-magnetic.
Huh.
Cannot make a magnet stick to it. And I'm just wondering, I haven't done a study on it to figure out what its specific gravity is or anything like that. But, it freaked me out because it looks like a hunk of iron and it rusts like a hunk of iron, but it doesn't magnetize.
But, okay, what when you say that it rusts like iron, what does it look like? Is it the kind of reddish brown crust?
Yeah,
on
yeah.
It?
Mm-hmm. I took my angle grinder and actually ground a face of it and left it out in the rain, and it rusted to reddish brown, just like iron, but it doesn't magnetize.
Is it a slag or is it a rock?
It's just a piece of stuff.
Yeah. When you ground it was shiny?
Yeah.
Was it very hard when you ground it?
Yes.
It was pretty hard.
Okay. There can be alloys of iron that aren't magnetic.
Course.
For example, there are grades of stainless steel. Some of them are magnetic and some of them are not. Now, an alloy with that still rusts and not being magnetic, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of that.
So this is something out of the ordinary?
Well,
yeah.
It could just take a little
bit of homework. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
If it's slag, so it came out of processing for iron, they would have selectively taken out the iron, and this is the leftover. It very well could be manganese-rich, but have trace amounts of iron, which are causing the rusting. But then it would be kind of like it wouldn't be a total black. It would be kind of a gray, like a steel gray, but not a light steel gray, more of a dark gray to the rock.
No, it absolutely shiny. You know, when I hit it with the grinder, it was absolutely shiny, like a piece of iron would be. If I ground a piece of iron, and then it rusted.
Did it give nice orange sparks when you ground it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. My guess is that it's some alloy that just doesn't happen to be magnetic.
Okay, so not a naturally occurring substance?
No.
No.
Okay.
All right, fair enough.
No, it's something weird. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do an SG on it and see what I can come up with.
Well, let us know on the next science forum, Jim. Not kidding.
We can bring density.
Thank you so much, and keep the Artie Shaw coming.
All right, man. Hey, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Over to Jeff in Albany. Jeff.
Hi. I just wanted to talk for a second again about tick removal.
All right.
And a lot of these, there's a lot of folk remedies and, kind of knowledge passed down that's incorrect.
Okay.
And basically, the appropriate way to remove a tick that's embedded into you is just to use tweezers. You're not supposed to put anything on it, or you run the risk of making the critter regurgitate more into you, which can, you know, basically increases your chances of getting any kind of bacteria that's in their gut.
So, I totally agree.
You go to the New York Department of Health website, they've got information on it, but you're not supposed to put anything on it. You're supposed to rub it down with alcohol after you remove the tick, but you're not supposed to put anything on the tick itself.
All right, fair enough.
I think they also would like you to put a triple antibiotic cream on the area where the tick was attached. So,
right, after you remove it, though, not while the tick is still there.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that. We appreciate the call, and our number here is 800-348-2551. Ed in Kingston is on. Ed.
Yes.
No, not Hi. You. In Kingston.
Hello.
You're on.
Thank you. The question is about a technology I've been reading about called CRISPR-Cas9. And
yes.
Apparently some bacteria have the capacity to release an enzyme that can destroy the DNA of a virus, or at least modify it so that future generations of the virus begin not to work, not to do their bad stuff. And humans apparently are now getting into a kind of emulating mode, but I don't understand how they do it. And if somebody knows how they do that, what the mechanism is, I'd appreciate knowing that.
Ed, would you mind listening off the air? Your phone line has got a terrible 60-cycle hum.
I'd be glad to.
All right, thanks a lot.
So CRISPR-Cas9 is a technology that biochemistry and molecular biology is very thankful for. It's been around for about a decade, and at first, when it was discovered, its discoverers kind of knew what its potential would be, but it took a while for us to really kind of get the gravity of it together. What CRISPR-Cas allows us to do is genetically edit DNA.
Huh.
So, say, for example, we have a critter, and say it's like an albino mouse, and we would like to create a genome that is just identical to that albino mouse but without the albino gene, then you can ask CRISPR-Cas to do just that and then effectively edit the DNA outside of it. This is done in a test tube.
Yeah.
And then you can reintroduce or try to reintroduce, which is the hard part, the new genetic code. So editing genetic code has become very easy and cheap in the scheme of molecular biology. But getting the new DNA to be expressed is more difficult, and that's the next piece.
Yeah.
But there's a wonderful article about CRISPR-Cas in Wired magazine earlier this year. I think it was the April issue. Maybe it was the – I mean, you can Google it and find it. It's available online. And it talks about the history of CRISPR-Cas and then the potential of what CRISPR-Cas can do for us.
Okay.
Yeah, because my understanding is basically you can tell the CRISPR-Cas enzyme exactly where to cut.
You give it a template, and you say, this is what I would like the DNA to look like. And then it goes out and it does it.
How do you give it a template?
It's called a primer. You give it, you tell it what the end of the sentence should look like. If you think of DNA as one long book.
Yeah.
And you say, find this sentence, find the end of this sentence, and cut here.
So it's like a search engine with cut and paste?
It's a biological search engine,
all
exactly.
Right. Let's go to Gordon in Kinderhook. Gordon.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call. And by the way, as a teacher, if I was a junior high school teacher, I would definitely recommend the Bryson book, Short History of Nearly Everything. I think it's one of the most fascinating reads I've ever done. That being said, my question regards measurable matter. How small is matter? How, you know, and I'm thinking this because one of my students asked me, a young child was reading Horton, Here's a Who, and the whole idea of, you know, something so small that a universe could exist like in our fingernail and we don't even know it. Is there limitations of measuring how small matter is based on the technology we have, or is there limits?
Okay.
I'll just make this statement. If something has size, it always can be divided in half, which basically to me means that there is no limitation in size, or okay. is there?
All right, we have about a minute here, so.
So indivisibility is one of the central tenets of chemistry, and physicists laugh at us for saying this because, of course, atoms are made up of subatomic particles. We just call them subatomic particles. But if I want to wear the chemist hat, as Jim will, I assume, too, is that we look at the atom as an indivisible, unique piece of matter. Unique in that depending on the number of protons you have, you're a different element. So hydrogen has one proton, one electron, and maybe a neutron, maybe not. Helium has double that. So, and their properties are based upon how many protons they have. And their reactivity has to do with how many electrons they have and where those electrons like to be energetically. So we look at that. We can measure the mass of one atom. That's 10 to the minus 24 grams if you want to put your zeros there. Yeah.
And in terms of size, the size of an atom or a small molecule is going to be about 1/1,000,000th the length of a yardstick.
What a great way to end the program. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, thanks all for being here. It was a fun show, right?
Fun show. Yeah.
Fairly normal by our standards.
I'd say so.
Well, good luck with the semester. We will see you all soon. Support comes from the Lake George Association, investing now to help keep Lake George waters clean for future generations, lakegeorgeassociation.org/join. Interim Healthcare, for 45 years working to help people age in place. Companion aides at nurses 7 days a week, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. Interimhealthcare.com. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. And College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing, full-service gas, including checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing, collegestreetmotors.com. Thanks again to our panel. Thanks to you for listening and for calling. Thanks to Deb Malik for answering the calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls and our producer, the absent Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, yeah, it's Food Friday. Hot dog. We'll see you then.